ability Rory's ghost was supposed to represent. And among the other things I never found out from Balow were how he determined there were precisely four ghosts, and how he discovered these four ghosts corresponded to the four deaths he described, especially since they were perfunctory in their haunting. For the most part, they just moaned or clanked a chain. They were ordinary ghosts, ordinary to the point of being hackneyed, he said. Sometimes he went so far as to speak to them about it, saying he expected something more original in the way of possession. But they never did better than bang cupboard doors and make footsteps when no one else was home. Their only point of novelty was that they lived in the heating system, a small stand-up oil burner in one corner of the living room. Into this they would retire late at night and sing Gregorian chants through the mica glass peephole. "But don't misunderstand him," said Balow. His speech was getting sloppy. These ghosts were dangerous even so. They had the power to curse people who were shirking their obligations. Every irresponsible person who had lived in the carriage house, and there seemed to be no other kind, had been cursed and come to a bad end. Woody Upton, for instance, the father of the twins, had married a shrewish girl from New Jersey and led an awful life. And Bill Elliott, who had lived there between Upton and Bob Werhauser, had been involved in a hit-and-run accident and was afterward plagued by sebaceous boils. And Werhauser, who had failed to protect his wife from Rory, and vice versa. Werhauser had a job at TV Guide now, writing the preview listings. A worse fate than that, Balow could not imagine. Then there was Forrester, who had shared the carriage house with Balow himself. I forget what Forrester's irresponsibility was, wasting a genius for something, I think. He was cursed, too. I was perplexed when Gary said so, because Forrester was at the other end of the bar that minute and looked fine. In fact, seemed to be having a swell time. But Balow snorted at my objection. "Cursed," he said. "Definitely cursed." "These ghosts," Balow repeated, "were dangerous to people who had responsibilities and refused to live up to them, dangerous to good people who had been slack about one thing or another. But he had never been bothered. He had escaped from them completely unscathed. Did I know why? I did not. It was because he, Balow, was completely worthless and vice-ridden. He was so totally reprehensible in his conduct that it was impossible to say that he had neglected any single responsibility. He was evil, you see, and the ghosts were powerless against him. They held sway only over good people gone wrong. He had outreached their grasp. He was worse than they ever were, and they could not so much as raise one of their 2-score spectral digits against him. Ha! He had them. Why, they all wound up rather friends, he said. And the only trouble they'd ever caused him was just when he was about to leave. He was sitting at the kitchen table writing letters telling various people his new address when inky black stuff dripped from the bare ceiling and blotted out his correspondence. And that was only because the ghosts were sad to see him go. He supposed it was a comfort to them to have someone in the house whom they had no mandate to torment. It was less work, he imagined. I'd have no trouble with the ghosts either, he was sure, for just the opposite reason. I was a clean-cut, reliable young man. I had paid for the last round. Those ghosts would have no bone to pick with me. I paid little attention to Balow's assurances, and I paid no attention to his warnings, as indeed people in ghost stories must never do. I needed some place to live, so I went to see Miss Beauregard in the mansion. She was peculiar and very old. Her house was littered with dirty and broken antiques, and the first thing Miss Beauregard told me was that she slept every night with a loaded .45 on her nightstand. Did I know a fellow called Gary Balow? I lied that I didn't. Please tell her if I met the man, because, she said, she was going to kill him. She gave me a warm can of beer and a plate of cold chicken wings, which I was afraid not to eat. Miss Beauregard owned a roadhouse, the Wagon Wheel, 8 or 10 miles out of town. Her equally ancient brother, Sawtell, ran a whorehouse behind the tavern, in what had once been tourist cabins. Balow's past roommate, Forrester, had worked for her once, tending bar. He told me later that Miss Beauregard and Sawtell quarreled all the time. He quit after one of those arguments. Miss Beauregard was standing next to Forrester behind the bar when Sawtell came in with a double-barreled shotgun. Forrester ducked, But Miss Beauregard pulled another shotgun from behind the counter and aimed it at her brother. They both fired, but so old and shaky were they that they missed each other with 12-gauge shot at a dozen paces. A drunk sleeping outside the door was startled, however, and ran out into the road, where he was killed by the car of the same Bill Elliott who was living in the carriage house then. One thing I had to understand about living out there, Miss Beauregard told me. The mansion was haunted. The fellow who had built it in the 1880s was a rich feed store owner. But his family took to spending his money faster than he could make it, and he took to the bottle. They ended broke and hiding from their creditors. They never lit a candle or answered the door, and finally when the sheriff came to evict them by force, he found the whole family dead inside. They'd killed themselves from shame. That was when Miss Beauregard had bought the house at auction. In 1910, she claimed. The original family was damned, and their spirits had to stay here on Earth, she said, and try to make amends for the wasteful lives they'd led. These ghosts would burn lights in the windows at all hours of the night, and make the front door open by itself to total strangers. I was to pay these things no never mind, said Miss Beauregard. And besides, the carriage house was all right. That was a modern place. It was mine for $65 a month. I made a deposit and left with the keys. My girlfriend Juanita and I lived in the carriage house for most of the winter of 1966 to 1967. It was a handsome little brick building with a tile roof. Inside there was one large room with the supposedly haunted oil burner in a corner and wide-arched casement windows on either side. At the back was a small kitchen with another arch of windows that looked out on a field and the woods beyond. The bathroom was small and almost all shower, like the head on a sailboat. But the hot water heater was much bigger than necessary, and we could stand in that shower for 90 minutes if we liked. In the living room there was a ladder that went up to a loft with a window in each gable. The place was clean and had been painted. We found a few pieces of used furniture for it, a table, a couple of chairs, and a mattress. Juanita quit school that fall and worked as a model for life drawing classes, so we had a little money. She was the most beautiful girl I have ever seen, small, tawny-skinned, with sleek dark hair and wide brown eyes. She had long legs and a very small waist that gave her hips, though slight, a perfect roundness. Her breasts were large, placed high on her chest, with hard, dark nipples. She cooked and kept house and treated me better than anyone ever has. We slept in a hug, arms and legs tangled together. I've never been able to sleep that way with anyone else. It's claustrophobic now, or an arm goes to sleep. We made love 2 or 3 times a day. Part of that was youth, but part of it was an attraction that cannot be explained at any age. I wanted to touch every part of her with my fingers, my cock, and my tongue. She rubbed me thick with soap lather once so I could try to push myself up between her buttocks, not knowing how much the soap would sting. But she just laughed when it hurt her. We stayed in the shower as much as we could, and in the bed when we weren't in the shower, and half naked all the time, even outside in the field. It was a very mild winter, freakishly warm for weeks at a time. Most mornings, when I got up to go to classes, there was an odor of timothy and alfalfa decaying in the fields, where it had been mown too late and damp for baling. It's a rare odor in the East, where I live now, that smell of rotting hay, and I'm glad it is, because I cannot smell it without overwhelming nostalgia, without crying, almost 15 years later. The carriage house was a perfect home to Juanita and me. We talked about how it could be fixed up and told each other we never wanted to leave. That there was something spooky about the place only made it more intimate, and we heard no moans or chains or Gregorian chants. But after sundown it always did seem to be darker outside our door than anywhere nearby, and sometimes the rungs on the ladder to the loft would creak, one after another, as though something were going upstairs. And there was, on still nights, a persistent thumping at one corner of the roof, where there were no pipes or tree branches or even squirrels that I could discover. So maybe Bala was right about the ghosts. Unfortunately, Bala was wrong about me. I was irresponsible. You fall in love with perhaps half a dozen people in your life, and a like number of people fall in love with you. But the affections are rarely mutual and almost never contemporary. It is the most irresponsible thing that can be done to let such a coincidence pass and not act upon it. Of course, I didn't know that. I thought that the world was infinitely supplied with romances, and that I would be the willing recipient of each in its turn. I was very young. But ignorance of natural law is a weaker excuse even than ignorance of the criminal code. I was in love with Juanita, but any man would have been. In fact, quite a few were. The remarkable thing was that she loved me. She asked me questions about myself, one sure way to tell. Where were you on this day exactly 10 years ago? What were you like when you were 12? She read my poetry. She even said she liked it. And she was the only person who has ever thought I was beautiful. I was sleeping one afternoon, naked on top of the bed, and woke to find her drawing me. On her sketch pad, I was an Adonis, which I was not. She loved me. She wanted us to live together until we died. She wanted to have a baby. I gave her a puppy instead. She wanted to get married, but I was a poor kid and I could see the future. Me with a teacher's salary and her at home with kids. A sea of small debts, rented homes, and used cars stretched out before us. A life like my parents' or hers. I'd get bald, she'd get fat, the kids would get in trouble. I was too cowardly to go through with it. And I was not yet 19. I'd never made love to anyone but Juanita. I wanted to fuck all the women in the world. So I did not do the decent thing and make her breasts and belly swell and buy a pair of matching gold-like rings. I didn't even treat her very well. I took her kindness for granted and yelled when there were no clean shirts. It's difficult to find someone who loves you, even more difficult not to abuse her for doing so. So Juanita and I lived in the carriage house, and I was very happy whether I knew it or not. The house creaked and pounded and made footfall noises, but the ghosts never harmed us until March. We were asleep on our mattress in the loft when, about 3 in the morning, I awoke with a fit of coughing that turned into a retching gag. I got up from the bed and tripped over the unconscious puppy. The air in the room was thick and sickening with fumes from the oil burner. I shook the dog, but it wouldn't wake. Then I shook Juanita, but she was unconscious too. I got her under one arm and the puppy under the other and went down the ladder. I don't know how. I'm not a strong person, and Juanita, although small, certainly weighed 100 pounds. With her in one hand and the dog in the other, that left no hand at all for the ladder rungs. But I did do it, crying and choking. I got them out the door and slapped Juanita until she came to. We went naked through the streets to a friend's house. There were little blue crescents at the base of Juanita's nails. She was sick for several days, and the puppy nearly died. It was an unnerving experience, the more so since the oil burner hadn't been lit for 3 weeks. I suppose we didn't entirely escape the curse. What happened between Juanita and me the next year was unpleasant, maybe tragic. Forrester didn't escape it either. He was drafted and killed at Hugh, and Ballow's estimate of his own depravity was overblown, it seems, for he drank himself to death that summer. A perfect couple. I met Iris Carr in the fall of 1965. I was sitting down when I saw her, and at first glance she seemed to be all legs. Of course, this was impossible, but there was more than the ordinary amount of leg to her, and more than the ordinary amount of breast and shiny black hair, and though she did not have more than the ordinary amount of face, the face she had was more than ordinarily striking. She seemed larger than life, and in fact, was considerably larger than the average female example of it. She was literally a great beauty. She caused me to whistle. Not a wolf whistle, but the whistle that sometimes happens by accident with a sharp intake of breath. She heard me, too, and was gracious about it, smiled politely, sat down 2 seats away in the college lecture hall, and arranged herself with that female inward folding of limbs. I saw her there every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 3 in the afternoon. We spoke, and she was friendly in a composed and remote fashion. I became fascinated by her. But though I was just 18 then, and my sexual fantasies were constant and Catholic, Iris did not enter them, not even when I tried to concentrate on her remarkable form. She was just too fundamental and overwhelming, almost frightening in her femininity. I could no more stimulate myself with thoughts of a lubricious Iris Carr than a pious Athenian could have jacked off over the goddess Diana. but she was amazing to look at. And she had a husband to match. Trevor Carr was rugged and handsome, too handsome. He was aware of being too handsome, and this made him too rugged. He was putting them both through college by modeling for menswear advertisements. He stood 6'4" at least, and exhibited more postures and attitudes of masculinity than are necessary except in times of national emergency. His speech and manner toward Iris were emphatic, dominant, and possessive. She responded with equanimity. People said they were a perfect couple. Perhaps they were. They were a little too vivid, like all perfect things. And like all perfect things, they were destined for destruction. And it is invariably satisfying to note that all perfect things are destined for destruction. Unfortunately, all imperfect things are destined for destruction also. But Iris was lonely. She said so to me. She called it being bored. "I'm so bored," she said. "My husband doesn't like to go out." She was too beautiful to have women friends, and I gathered that Trevor was too jealous to let her be friends with a man. So when Iris and Trevor were seen, they were seen together. Trevor even began to audit those of Iris's classes where he wasn't already enrolled. After that, she still smiled at me, but she didn't say much. Iris was from Oregon. Trevor was from New York. They had both come to the school in Ohio 2 years before. They met during the first week of their freshman year, dated steadily for 6 months, and were married. They rented a house on the edge of campus. On holidays and breaks, Trevor flew east to be photographed, and Iris flew west to see her family. Anyone who watched Iris, and I watched Iris as much as decency and Geology 101 allowed, could see she was restless. And anyone who watched Trevor, and if you watched Iris, you could not help watching Trevor, could see that he was restless also. He didn't seem to be interested in other women, and he was too busy keeping Iris away from men to make friends with any of them. I believe he was as lonely as she. In the spring of 1966, Iris did something to solve at least her own isolation by making friends with Gary Ballow. Ballow was an ex-student in his late 20s and a soi-disant writer, though really more of a budding alcoholic, living on an allowance he received from his family with the stipulation that he never set foot in Grosse Pointe, Michigan again. But, more important, he was a homosexual. Therefore, he could associate with Iris to Trevor's heart's content. Iris began to divide her time between Trevor and Gary. She'd spend her evenings at Gary's apartment while Trevor fiddled with his gun collection. Ballow was a smart man and a lover of beauty and perfection in everything except his personal habits. He told people that Iris was a girl who could be shaped into the mythic dimensions of womanhood. It is something I've never understood about homosexuals, their interest in the mythic dimensions of womanhood, who have so little use for real women. But anyway, because of Gary's acquaintance or through his tutelage or something, Iris changed. She became more lively, talkative, more typically womanish. I guess one would say she gained self-confidence, and, what is even rarer in a beautiful woman, she gained some degree of wit. I remember her telling Trevor one night in the J Bar where we all spent our evenings, "Why don't you go flirt with someone, Trevor? It would pep things up and do wonders for everyone's opinion of you." Trevor did not laugh, but he went off to play the pinball machine, leaving me and two other young men alone with Iris for the first time I could recall. But it was curious to me that Iris's liveliness made her no less remote. She was one of those very unusual people who became more mysterious by being chatty and familiar than they do through silence and austerity of manner. But what was more curious was that Trevor did not dislike Gary. I had expected that Trevor, even if he approved of his wife's association with Ballow, would be uneasy with the man himself. But this wasn't so. Trevor would fulminate in general about fags and cocksuckers, but he seemed to genuinely like this example of the kind. And Gary was polite enough or careful enough not to make fun of Trevor's exaggerated masculinity. Gary told Trevor that Trevor was not his type. He said he liked cute and sissy little blonde fellows. This was a lie, but Trevor believed it, and he was safe to do so. Ballow wasn't interested in Trevor. No one but Iris ever was, not even as a friend. Once Trevor had been relieved of shielding Iris from all things heterosexual, and thus joined in the normal male pursuits of the town, he proved to be a companion of no merit. He couldn't hold his liquor, and didn't have a thought in his head. This combined poorly with his heavy drinking and penchant for endless talk. It also amused him to start fights, and amused him more to let others finish them. He wasn't even a good hunting or fishing pal. He insisted on dry-fly thrashings at the runoff from the local reservoir, water that was populated only by bullhead and carp. He hunted pheasants as though these animals were a danger to the natives' livestock, and during deer season he was a considerable danger to the natives' livestock himself. But Trevor seemed happy, and Iris seemed happy, and Gary seemed happy, too. Iris's poise was elevated by double attentiveness. Gary's style was decorated by two attractive people, and Trevor's aggression was emphasized by twin examples of apparent passivity. They made their own miniature social set, and their names ran together as a compound noun, and by the next year they all talked alike. If one met them separately, they would each say the same thing. Iris would say it in a womanly manner, Trevor would say it in a manly manner, and Ballow would say it as it had been said in the first place. That fall, in 1966, a young man named Jack Becker returned from Vietnam and enrolled at the college. He'd been a Green Beret sergeant, and this had not been a pleasant experience. He was a funny-looking guy, full of nervous energy, and tremendously glad to be back in the United States. He was in college, he said, because it was the closest thing to doing nothing that he could find, and that his GI benefits would pay for. He was in a nearly constant state of euphoria, more than a little of it chemically induced. He didn't give a damn about anything now but having fun, he said, and he was certainly open to any suggested activity remotely construable as that. He insisted on drinking at every hour of the day, and could not resist any drug, no matter how loathsome its effects were known to be. He'd juxtapose it to the leeches and clap of Indochina, and pronounce the narcotic delectable of sensation by comparison. He bought a huge Harley-Davidson motorcycle, and drove it worse and faster than anyone I've ever seen, and right into people's houses out of pure good fellowship and eagerness of greeting. And for sex, he'd do anything also, sometimes flopping backward over a table at the J-bar, pulling out his reproductive organs and yelling, "Take me, anyone!" adding with some wistfulness, "But gently." Jack was an appealing character. He had actually been somewhere. Most of us had only been to college. He had had real and violent, dangerous adult experiences involving not just death, which seems familiar to the romantic adolescent mind, but responsibility, which does not. And not only had he been out in the world, but he had come back from it acting more like us than we did. This was affirming. Also, opposition to the war in Indochina was then beginning to eclipse civil rights as the chief orthodoxy of the nonconformists. Iris said the draft was an invitation from people we have not yet met to go to a place which we have never heard in order to shoot people whom we do not know. And what's worse, she said, they are expected to shoot back. Whatever, it was an issue that touched home. Becker's first-hand opinion of the thing confirmed our most dreadful hopes. Everyone liked him. Everyone liked Becker, and Becker liked everyone. But he liked Iris best. "That is a white woman," he said the first time he saw her. It was the middle of the day. Iris didn't say anything. They walked out of the bar together, and didn't come back for 3 hours. It was clear, in a general way, where they went. Specifically, they went to my house, where my girlfriend and I were taking a nap. We got up and gave them the bed. It was an urgent case. Then we sat on the lawn and listened to them. Jack made a great deal of noise, and surprisingly, so did Iris. But the sounds that Iris made were the only dignified lovemaking noises I have ever heard. They were chilling. Iris and Jack's affair was passionate to the point of psychotic compulsion, and fully public because Jack had no fixed home and bedded down wherever he could, and so did he and Iris. They were continually being walked in on and caught in the bedrooms, bathrooms, living rooms, and any other rooms of acquaintances and half-strangers. Iris was always said to look quite composed on these occasions. They were at my house almost daily, and I know that was only one of a dozen places they regularly went. Jack must have been a man of great biological capabilities, and more than a little daring. They were reported by one person or another as having achieved the act of Congress in the most remarkable places, in a tree, for instance, or in the beer cooler at the J-bar, or on a piano in the music building, or from the back through a gap in Iris's skirt while packed in a crowd at a football game, or in the footwell of a sympathetic graduate instructor's desk while the instructor conferred with a student on a midterm paper. They screwed everywhere but on crowded street corners in broad daylight, and some people said they did it there. One person even claimed to have seen them rolling down the highway on Jack's motorcycle with Iris nude from the waist down, holding the handlebars, and Jack sliding into her from the jump seat. But I don't think this last thing was true. Iris was not the kind of girl who would have known how to shift gears on a motorcycle. Iris and Jack's affair was so obvious that even a husband must have noticed it, and Trevor was still a very jealous man. But this jealousy did not extend to Jack any more than it did to Gary Ballow. Jack was Trevor's hero. Trevor was always pestering him for details about the military ordnance, rates of fire, and types of explosives, about tactical details and strategies, and always asking him to tell war stories. There was only one war story Becker had any interest in telling, and he was tired of telling that. He'd hated the Vietnamese, he said. The ones on our side weren't on our side, and the ones who weren't on our side were a nasty bunch. He had been out on patrol once in an area more hostile than most when something moved in the brush. The point man of his squad and another soldier emptied 4 or 5 clips into the shrubbery. A rifle and the body of an 8 or 9-year-old girl fell out onto the path. Perhaps she was carrying the rifle somewhere for someone, or perhaps she really meant to plunk a GI, though there was more gun than girl. Anyway, when Becker got to the front of his squad, the two soldiers were standing beside the body arguing. Jack said he assumed they were accusing each other of killing the child. He said he couldn't now imagine why he'd thought that, but that was what had occurred to him at the time. They were not accusing each other. They were quarreling about who had made the kill and who would get to search the body for papers. There were no papers, said Becker. She was just a little girl. She didn't even have pockets to put papers in. It was a pathetic sight. She'd been a pretty little girl, too. And if she'd really meant to kill them, then it was a very pathetic sight indeed, sickening and horrid. The soldiers kept arguing, and Jack said he felt, all of a sudden, caught in the middle of something without beginning or end. He said he felt awful. "Boy, war must be awful," said Trevor one night when he'd had Jack tell the story for the half-dozenth time. "What kind of gun did she have?" Several times I noticed Trevor using mannerisms or patterns of speech that were definitely Jack's. The only trouble Trevor gave Iris and Jack was by tagging along. This resulted in some extraordinary scenes. Jack once fucked her while they were supposed to be playing pinball in a dark corner of the J Bar. Iris bent over the machine with her slacks down, trying to keep the bells and buzzers going, and an eye on her husband at the bar. Another time, I heard, Jack had Iris in the same way, or at least effected penetration, while they both leaned out the window and talked to Trevor as he mowed the lawn. Gary Ballow wasn't jealous of Jack's affair with Iris either. He fell in love with Jack himself. Becker didn't mind. By Christmas, he and Gary were sleeping together also. Becker was as fond of Ballow as he was impassioned with Iris. I thought this the first time I saw Jack read a book, and I was sure of it when I heard him say something about Artemis and Leto and the great mother of the gods. That was not how Becker had talked when I first met him. It was a less obstreperous affair than his relationship with Iris, but again, it was obvious what was going on. People even mentioned it to Trevor, though Trevor denied that he'd heard any such thing. And Ballow and Iris became more intimate than before, always whispering together. Someone later told me Gary and Iris tried to have intercourse, but Gary couldn't do it. Now they both fucked Becker. But I did not hear that the three of them got it in bed together. It was as though some peculiar delicacy or balance was being maintained. It was a juggling act I didn't understand. Trevor, Jack, and Gary would also go round together sometimes, making as strange as possible a boy's night out, three people so diverse in character that it was hard to imagine them on the same planet, let alone in the same booth at the J Bar. And if Iris joined them, their peculiar personalities would turn more peculiar. Trevor would bellow louder, crack the tops off beer bottles and drink from the jagged neck. Gary would turn viciously effeminate, and Jack's omnivorous good humor would reach to a pitch of hysteria. All the while, Iris grew ever more beautiful and remote and imaginary to those of us who weren't involved. This situation endured for a remarkable length of time, that is, for about 3 months. Then it exploded. I don't know exactly what happened, but I had a theory, and I heard a rumor and the rumor I heard was close enough to the theory I had for the both of them to stand together in the place of fact. Trevor had made a pass at Gary. Maybe he sought to complete the circle. Maybe he was impressed by the facility with which emotional molecules can be rearranged. Maybe he thought the polarities of human relationships were so easily reversed. Or maybe he was just queer. It was Trevor, of course, not Gary, who reacted with shock to what Trevor did. Iris was giving a party that night, with mostly Becker's friends there. Trevor ran down into the basement and locked himself in and began shooting through the floorboards at the guests with a submachine gun. Fortunately, it was only a .22-caliber replica of an old-fashioned Thompson, one of those things that in those days could be bought through the mail and which Trevor had converted to fully automatic fire. The slugs didn't have enough force to penetrate the hardwood parquet squares. Here and there, a little leaden nose would poke up through some splinters. That was all. But the guests panicked and ran out of the house. And when they did, Trevor fired out the basement windows after them. But these windows were sunk into deep wells along the foundation, and Trevor could not shoot out of them except almost straight up, and was only able to shatter a street light. Iris began to yell at him in language that cannot be reproduced. Now there is no longer any such thing as language too strong to be printed, though Iris's was very strong. It was the even, ladylike tone in which she delivered her invective that defies replication. She told Trevor what she thought of him, and she told him what everyone thought of him, and what Jack thought of him, and what she and Jack had been doing, and what Jack and Ballow had been doing. And I think she was about to start in on what he had been about to do with Gary when Becker went crazy, which he did with a heart-stopping howl, a sort of terrible scream, and then animal hollering. He went through the hedges and over the neighboring backyard fences as though pursued by something awful, or in pursuit of it. I couldn't tell which. Then Trevor came out of the cellar bulkhead, unarmed, and said, "Is there something the matter with Jack?" Jack clambered a mile across town through garden plots and clotheslines to my house. He took my shotgun from the corner of the living room, and the whole night long performed a frenzied zigzag of advances or retreats through the town's shrubbery. About 50 people called the police, who assumed, and were not told otherwise, that it was Jack who had shot up Iris in Trevor's basement. They called out every member of the force, and the university's security guards and the volunteer fire department besides, and cordoned off everything they could think of to cordon off, and threw up barricades whenever it occurred to them, and launched a general dragnet of alleys and shrubbery. But on any warm spring night in a college town, there are so many youngsters running wild through backyards and making loud noises that the search came to nothing, and the police found only a few half-dressed dates and some adolescents poisoned by beer. I guess Becker was acting out his combat experiences. Or maybe he was acting out the combat experiences of others. Perhaps he was even acting out combat experiences dating well back into the previous century, because when I finally retrieved my old Belgian side-by-side, my only possession of any value, it was stuffed with leaves and dirt that had been rammed down the barrels with a beanpole or a stick, as though it were a muzzle loader. Becker quieted down about dawn and went back to Ballow's apartment and hid under a bed. Iris seemed to hold Ballow responsible for her husband's behavior, or Jack's, or her own, or for something. Anyway, she went over there at 9 that morning and hauled Becker out from under the bed and took him away. I don't know what she said to Ballow, but it must have affected him, because when she and Jack left, he tried to commit suicide by throwing himself out his apartment window. He ran straight at the closed casement and burst through the glass. This cut him badly, but it did not kill him, because he rented the first floor of a duplex and fell about 2 feet into a flower bed. So he went back inside and threw himself through another window, and repeated this action until every window on his floor of the house had been smashed. Finally, he threw himself through the storm door and lay unconscious in splashes of blood on the front porch. I think it was Trevor who took him to the hospital. Jack didn't stay with Iris very long. Later that afternoon, he got away and re-enlisted at the post office. Then he disappeared. I suppose he went back to Vietnam. No one ever heard of him again. Trevor checked into a motel on the edge of town that night and shot himself through the roof of the mouth. Ballow recovered from his cuts, but by August he had drunk himself to death. Something awful should have happened to Iris also, to round out the story, but she finished school that spring and moved to Boston, where she married a wealthy older man. They live on Beacon Hill to this day, and summer at Lambert's Cove. an atheist in the foxhole. I got an unexpected phone call last October from a friend of mine, Calvert Fell. Calvert is a native of Maryland, a banker and a sportsman. It was not like him to be more than a skillful shot away from the eastern shore during duck season. But he said his son and the son's wife had bought land in Vermont an hour's drive from my place. "Come over," said Calvert. "I'm being bored to death." This son is about my age, but I had never met him. I think he'd gone to school somewhere in the West and been in the Peace Corps for several years. Calvert was not being bored to death, of course, but he was being bored into a very bad mood, and that's worse as far as Calvert is concerned, since, he says, there is nothing dramatic about facing a bad mood with dignity. The son, named Charles, called Chucky, and the wife, Anna, two short A's, were lacto-ovo vegetarians, did not allow smoking in their house, and brewed their own beer, which tasted like nothing so much as bread dough dissolved in mud. I had hoped Calvert and I could find some beaver ponds to jump shoot. But the National Rifle Association decal on the windshield of my Jeep sent Chucky into a soliloquy on firearm registration, and after that I didn't have the nerve to get the guns out. Calvert and I spent a gray afternoon around a kitchen table half-stripped of perfectly good paint, discussing green wood stoves with the junior Fells. Chucky and Anna said green wood was an excellent fuel. The chilly room argued otherwise. At last, the baby, born 6 weeks before the wedding, named Dovie, sex not determined, needed something. I could swear the parents said aerobic dance exercise, but that can't be true. Or can it? Anyway, Calvert and I were free for an hour to wander the grounds, or whatever one calls 175 acres of former Christmas tree farm and abandoned gravel quarry. We peeked into the unfinished chicken coop. Leghorn hens nested in the sawdust and hand tools. "God knows what they're going to serve for dinner," said Calvert. I invited him to come back with me and have a steak. "No, no," he said. "I couldn't do that. Charles, that is, Chuck, and I are just beginning to see eye to eye again." "I didn't know you'd had a falling out with your son." "Oh, nothing like that. We just didn't see eye to eye for 10 or 15 years. Calvert kicked at a large box trap on the chicken coop floor. It was baited with soy protein. "Take this thing, for instance," he said. "This is how he's going to catch a fox, because he doesn't like to take a life. Even assuming there is a fox dumb enough to crawl into this, what's going to happen? He'll take the fox out. The fox will come back and get in the trap. He'll take the fox out. The fox will come back. He'll take the fox out." I admitted it was too humane for me. "Before," said Calvert, "he and I wouldn't have seen eye to eye about a thing like this."
"You mean you agree with him?"
"Absolutely. He believes he's being moral. I believe he's being stupid. We're in perfect agreement." Calvert sat down on the box trap. "But a few years ago, we would have had a huge fight."
"Really? Over a fox?"
"Oh, yes," said Calvert. "You know how it is with my generation. We can be very stout-headed." "Why, I know about a man who got in a fight with his son over a fox, a much worse fight than that. He was master of hounds at the Carroll County Hunt Club." I got a bottle of scotch from the Jeep. Fox hunting is something I have no notion of, and a long story about it can be worse than a syndicated bridge column. "I hear the members drink a lot," I said, hoping to change the subject.
"Haven't been there for years," said Calvert, and he made a dismissive wave with my whiskey bottle to indicate he had begun a tale. "Anyway, this man was a really average hunter, and his son was an awful hippie sort of fella." More or less involuntarily, I glanced toward the house. "Oh, much worse than that. A great hairy sort of mystical hippie always talking about Hindu people and how President What's-His-Name was going to be reincarnated as a goat, which I personally don't doubt. But be that as it may, he was positively the worst son I ever saw a man have. He and his father were always arguing. They argued about politics, they argued about drugs, they argued about the right to ownership of private property. And finally, they got in an enormous, really monstrous argument about religion. I thought it was about a fox." Calvert took a large drink. furry little animals, religion. All comes to the same thing, if you know what I mean.
I didn't.
Where was I? Well, it was right there at the Hunt Club. I can't think why they let that boy in, except his father was so rich. And that was just what he was yelling at his father about. Said his father was too rich to know God. I'm afraid the son had a point. The old man was completely unreligious. I don't think he'd ever had a metaphysical thought in his life. And no doubt about it, wealth makes materialism easier to bear. But that doesn't excuse the boy's manners, telling his father he was too rich in front of half the money in Maryland. Then he began to shout that this was why his father and his father's friends had killed all those people in Nagasaki and were killing them again just then in Vietnam. Though I assure you not a single person the father knew had had a role in government since Wilkie was defeated. The boy just would not shut up. He said he'd studied real religion and all the mystical truths of the East and so on. He claimed he understood the sanctity and eternal existence of the soul in all its forms, or something like that. And then he turned on everyone in the room and shrieked, "Fox hunting! Fox hunting is just what I'd expect out of a lot of murderers like you. Why, the fox is a million times more in tune with the universe than you are, a more developed being on any scale." By this time, the father had had enough. He picked the son up by the scruff of the neck and marched him out into the parking lot, meaning to bang his head against the side of the station car. But as soon as they were alone, the son lowered his voice and said, "You may be strong, but you don't have the power of enlightenment." Well, this was said in such a confident and uncharacteristically dangerous-sounding way that the father let go, whereupon the son did and said some kind of oddball Oriental thing and turned the master of hounds into a fox himself right there practically in the suburbs of Baltimore. I took the bottle back from Calvert. "Well, that's how the father tells it," he said, and took the bottle back from me. Of course, he ended up being hunted not a week later, too, and by his own hounds and his own former friends. You can imagine how he felt.
Must have been interesting.
Exactly, said Calvert. He loved it. You know how built up Maryland is getting. It didn't take long for this new fox to get his pack and the crowd of hunters into some very unfamiliar territory indeed. He ran them right through a shopping center. Mrs. Elmer Buxley and young Burton Combs were both unhorsed in a Sears muffler center. Elliot Templeton rode through the window of Hertzenfeld's jewelry store and was shot dead by Mr. Hertzenfeld, who was later let off by the courts when it was discovered that he'd been forced by his wife to take an entire Cub Scout pack to see the Wild Bunch the night before. Half a dozen of the hounds ran into the Golden Dragon Inn and never emerged. Two others jumped on a woman and a fox stole and were killed by her schnauzer. Mrs. Arnold Fricks had a very fine Irish hunter that took a magnificent jump at a Chevy Suburban it mistook for a 5-bar gate. They got tangled in the luggage rack and were last seen headed for Silver Spring with a load of marigold flats. The fox, that is the master of hounds, hid in the men's cologne department of Wanamaker's, completely disguised by test atomizers of Brute and Canoe, and the rest of the pack was eventually run over on I-95. Of course, the hippie son felt terrible about all this carnage. He dropped the mystical nonsense immediately and took up a more prosaic form of hippiness, something in the organic gardening line, I think. Calvert handed me the scotch bottle and picked up a hen from on top of a skill saw. He stroked its feathers absently. "What happened to the fox?" I said. "Oh, the spell wore off eventually," said Calvert,
and he bent over and took a huge bloody bite out of the live chicken's back. Days of Wage, National Lampoon, 1972 to 1981. The National Lampoon was founded in 1970 by Doug Kenny, Henry Beard, and Rob Hoffman. I started to write for the magazine as a freelancer when I first came to New York and was hired full-time in 1973, starting out in low puns, working my way up through rude japes, wisecracks, and witty riposts until I finally became editor-in-chief. The National Lampoon was my writing education, and it gave me the one academic idea I've ever had. If I wind up a drunk hack with nothing left to say and nowhere to say it, well, when I do, I intend to follow in the weaving footsteps of many a better scribbler and get a job teaching creative writing at college. Then I will assign the kids nothing but parodies. First, this will spare me from reading endless, sensitive, self-obsessed, first-person mewling, vide previous section of present volume. And second, it will teach the whelps to write. At the National Lampoon, we parodied every type and style of prose. To do this, it was necessary for us to understand the construction and workings of the objects of ridicule. My job was that of an aspiring watchmaker disassembling a fine timepiece. There I was with a thing of value and beauty, pulling it apart, ruining it for everyone, scattering small, useless springs and gears of irony and derision all over the literary workbench, and perhaps I should go back to the National Lampoon and study metaphor. A few thoughts on humor and humorists. Foreword to a 1980 National Lampoon anthology. The most important thing in life is to have a sense of humor. A sense of humor is more important than food, because if you have a sense of humor, you can laugh even though you're starving. While if you laugh too hard on a full stomach, you'll throw up. It's often said that laughter is the best medicine. This actually isn't true. Penicillin is the best medicine, followed by tetracycline and the sulfa drugs. But, judging by what a joke the Carter administration's State Department turned out to be, laughter is the best foreign policy. In fact, laughter serves many purposes. Laughter is the way we cope with conflicting emotions. For example, your mother is dying of cancer. You're sorry she's dying, but she's been in pain, so you're also relieved by the prospect of her imminent demise. Why not kid her about it? Put on a little skit. Wear her bedpan on your head and use the oxygen tent noises to pretend you're Darth Vader. Laughter alleviates fear, too. Your mother really won't mind dying now, especially if the bedpan was full and she saw you stick your head in it. Humor can be an effective substitute for aggression, the way it was for Roberto Duran in the second Sugar Ray Leonard match. Sugar Ray may have won the fight, but it was Duran everybody laughed at. And humor can also be used as a defense. Humor was used as a defense in the trial of Richard Speck. Speck's attorneys claimed their client should be freed because one of the investigating officers, upon entering the building where all the dead nurses were found, was heard to say, "There's something funny going on here." Still, what is amusing to one person may seem simply squashed flat and run over in the road to another. And what is considered unattractive and sad by some may be peeled up and sailed through the window of the girls' gym by others. What do we really mean by the word humor? Consider the following list of common colloquial phrases involving mirth. When people say, "That's funny," they actually mean, "That's not funny." When people say, "Don't make me laugh," they actually mean, "That's not funny." When people say, "That's not funny," they actually mean, "That's funny." When people say, "She has a wonderful sense of humor," they actually mean, "Don't make me laugh." Yet there are many things that do make people laugh, and sometimes people laugh for no apparent reason. For instance, let's examine a room full of teenage girls at a slumber party. They are all giggling. Let's examine them very carefully. We'll say we're doctors or something. What are these girls giggling about? They're probably discussing sex. Perhaps their humor is a means of coping with fear, like the time you spilled a bedpan all over your dying mother. But there's no reason for young girls to be afraid of sex. We'll be gentle. Of course, unless they've been naughty already, it's still going to hurt a little bit. So maybe they're using humor as a defense mechanism like Richard Speck did. But Richard Speck was convicted. And we will be too if that was Mom and Dad who just pulled in the driveway. Even if the causes of laughter cannot be exactly defined, there are still several recognizable types of humorous activity. There is parody, when you make fun of people who are smarter than you. Satire, when you make fun of people who are richer than you. And burlesque, when you make fun of both while taking off your clothes. But the key to all types of humor probably lies in the folk saying, "I didn't know whether to laugh or cry." Or possibly in the folk saying, "I didn't know whether to shit or go blind." The latter would seem to be an easy choice, but the truly funny person may have trouble making up his mind. For a real humorist is a special sort of person, a man apart, different from the rest of us. He brings to everyone around him the wonderful and unexpected gift of laughter. Think of him this way. If all the world were a church, and all the people in the world were silent prayers going up to heaven, the humorist would be a fart from the pulpit. Yet another excerpt still from Unpaid Bills by Truman Garbage. There have been more tears shed over unpaid bills than over any others, the author's accountant. Editor's note. For some years now, Mr. Garbage has been devoting his time exclusively to the writing of a major novel, Unpaid Bills. Several excerpts from this work in progress have already appeared in other publications, most notably Le Boeuf et Brou, 1965, which told the tale of a wealthy society matron whose breath was murder, and Red Desert, the story of a woman who deliberately left her blind husband in a Michelangelo Antonioni movie. More recently, we've been treated to the appearance in print of Horrible Icky People, part of the middle and some of the end of my big new book, and Sky King's Niece Penny. Now, the honor of publishing Mr. Garbage's last segment of Unpaid Bills has fallen to the National Lampoon. Therefore, without further comment, even though it doesn't seem to be quite finished and really could use a lot of work, we are pleased to present La Rente et Due. Coco Chanel used to fart in bed and pull the sheets up over her nose. It was Mrs. Important last name, Impy to her friends, who was doing the talking. A big, breezy, peppy broad, built exactly like a man in every detail, and raised on a ranch in Cleveland. We were sitting in the good booth next to the steam table in Le Café Olé. Outside, it was a day filled with adverb, adjective, adverb, adverb, adjective. But inside the hallowed precincts of Le Café, all was used to le monde, art déco, and snobisme, especially snobisme. Le Café is owned by Monsieur Olé, the same fabled restaurateur who for years ran Le Côte aux Brisquettes, that landmark of très chic, where ordinary rich people or garden-variety celebrities were merely shown to a comfortable table and served a delicious meal, but where the truly, truly select were made to squat outdoors on the sidewalk and eat offal. Le Café is a more casual restaurant. A simple seat close to the men's room is enough to show the esteem in which you're held by its proprietor, and Impy and I could see every inch of the urinals. Not that many men pee standing up in Le Café. Lee Radziwill came in the door and was shown to a table with Andrew Mellon, Dick Van Dyke, Gary and Pierre Trudeau, and Baron Rothschild Lafitte. Le Café is a quiet bastion of wealth, a watering hole for the world's great fortunes, a culinary retreat at midday for the well-heeled and the well-fixed. And Impy could afford it. This was her milieu. She had married a doctor. Brandon de Wilde was seated next to us with Alice Roosevelt Longworth and Countess Maria T.S. Monty Python came in with Houghton Mifflin and Tatum O'Neill. Charo was having cocktails with Anheuser-Busch, the young brewery heir. And Merrill Lynch, Pierce Fenner, Jean Shrimpton, and Ralston Purina all arrived with a very prominent woman who's the Queen of England. Carol Channing had been there yesterday. Impy and I were having brunch together, a sort of combination breakfast and lunch. But when Monsieur Olé glided to our table with menu in hand, Impy regally waved him away, ordering instead bottle after bottle of "Call Byron over to Esquire and get the name of that really expensive kind of cold duck." My name is P.J. Clark, and I'm of two minds. Whether to skillfully weave my personal history into the warp and woof of a subtle plot structure that evolves through the play and counterplay of mimetic imagery to reveal my narrative point of view as an integral part of this literary work, or whether to just dump my life story into your lap out of a sheer lack of writing ability. I've been peddling my ass since before I could walk. When I was 6 months old, I was already performing sex acts for money, or even for a change of diapers. I wouldn't shit in my potty unless somebody gave me a quarter. I said, "If you want the kinky stuff, you're going to have to pay." Later, when I was growing up, I wouldn't jack off unless I found money under the couch cushions. I'd suck the legs of a chair just to sit down. There was nothing I wouldn't do. And where I grew up, everybody was queer, too. All the kids in the neighborhood were queer. The nuns at school were queer. A lot of the trees and plants in our yard were queer. My dad was queer. The only way he could get Mom pregnant was to blow himself and spit at her ass. I even had queer toys. I let my teddy bear fuck me, but he had to give me his little button eyes first. You bet he did. Then, when I was 4, I ran away from home, and this real rich man was passing by in his jet airplane and gave me a lift. He had me stick beans in his ears with my Peter. He was really in love with me and gave me bundles of money and took me all over the world. We went yachting in Aspen and skied the Riviera, and he taught me all the really important things to know if you're going to be friends with high society types, like that you're supposed to keep the napkins and wash them and use them over again, and don't wear a blue suit without socks. Since then, I've been everywhere, even Europe, and always hung around with really, really rich people who just adore me because I'm so good-looking and have lots of manners, even though right now I'm living in the YMCA and I'm a male whore. Or was, until I got this job as the self-conscious motor-mouthed narrator in Truman's new novel, just in case anybody sues. That's why it's really important to remember that I'm very good-looking. That way, you won't get me mixed up with Truman. I'm really good-looking, and people pay to fuck me. So this can't possibly be Truman's thinly disguised real-life story. Because can you imagine anybody paying to fuck Truman? That would be perverted. Actually, Truman wasn't so bad-looking when he was young. But he sold his soul in a Polish Dorian Gray deal. He made an agreement with the devil so that the photograph on the back of his first novel's dust jacket will always remain exactly the same, and all the horrible, disgusting stuff happens to him. Over the empty cold duck bottles, Impey begins a fascinating story of scandal and intrigue, all completely true, involving Lauren Bacall, the Tate LaBianca killings, and 3 presidents of the United States. None of the names have been changed either. It begins in the August 1968 Esquire and continues in February and June 1969. Then in Argosy, May 1970, McCall's, December 1971, Commonwealth, March 1973, the Kansas City Star Sunday Magazine section, September 15, 1975, and ends as a poem in last week's New Yorker. Though you probably won't be able to make heads or tails of it without referring to the October 1968 Red Book, short story complete, on these 2 pages. In the meantime, I listened to the conversations buzzing around me. I could just overhear Wallace Simpson huddled with Margot Hemingway and Ford Maddox Ford, whispering the story of Judge Crater. "Changed his name to Carter," she intoned, "and had a chain of car washes in Buffalo and Rochester. Carter's Car Clean, I think they're called. Son, by his second marriage, still runs them. Never found out who his old man really was." 2 tables away, Stavros Niarchos was tete-a-tete with Mrs. Robert Taft. "It was never really a government spy mission," she was saying. "She was just supposed to keep her eyes open. But she was captured. Naturally, they treated her very respectfully. Missy Elhaut this, and Missy Elhaut that. She was really rather enjoying herself, I'd say. Died of intestinal blockage in 1944 in Kyoto." Closer to our left, Bianca Jagger and the president of General Motors discussed assassinations. "Actually," sighed Bianca, "the second gunman was 1 floor down in the book depository and 3 windows to the left. Sergio Connors, a half-Mexican, half-Irish guy. The same fellow who shot Marty King."
"Oh, yeah, I remember him," said the president.
"Well, he lives right over in Queens, 3506 Woodside Avenue, apartment 9 or 10L, I can never remember which." Farther away, but still audible, were Esther Williams and Nadia Comaneci chatting with Nelson Rockefeller, whose close friends call him Deep Throat. Esther was telling them about the real Howard Hughes will. "Sizable trust funds for the family, of course, but the bulk of the estate's left to the Air and Space Museum at the Smithsonian. It's all perfectly signed and witnessed and notarized, and it's in the Ogden, Utah Public Library, tucked inside the flyleaf of World Enough and Time by Robert Penn Warren. But it's been ages since anybody checked out one of Bobby's books."
"You know that story, The Lady or the Tiger? The one by Frank Stockton?"
I was listening again to Wally Simpson.
"Well, he gets the lady. The man in the iron mask was just some pretty noble who killed his wig maker. He wore that mask all the time because he had a hare lip. And the last five bars of Schubert's Unfinished Symphony go like this. Bum, bum.